Welcome to the Potential Leader Lab, and I'm your host, Perry Moffmer. And on this episode, number 74, I am talking to Joe Boyd, and we're going to talk about how stories and storytelling drive emotions and connection with people. And I hope you really enjoy the conversation with Joe. And without further ado, here it is. All right, Joe. Well, it's great having you on the podcast. I know we could go a lot of different ways with this, but I thought we'd start with, I guess I want to tie in, I love what you do with storytelling, and I think it's really important for leaders and organizations and individuals, and I like how you leverage Campbell's work. So why don't we start with that? Why don't you take us through how you came up with that, what your kind of version of that is, and how you help people, and then we'll just roll with some questions after everybody gets a firm understanding of how you approach it.
Sure. I've been a storyteller my whole life, so I guess I approach it as someone who sort of naturally understood story kind of growing up and was an actor and a performer. I grew up kind of religious and went to seminary and was a preacher for a while, but all that is sort of similar in the sense of you're trying to get people's attention through a story. And one of the things I noticed, I guess, even through my like early religious training and practice is that stories motivate people and create feelings, and facts and data and commands don't. So early on, I was a good storyteller, and then I saw the power of it. And that led me to study storytelling in and of itself. Reading Joseph Campbell's work and that leading me to folks like Carl Jung and others to kind of help me see that we are all living our own story. And we all sort of put ourselves in the hero role. If your listeners don't know, Campbell's most famous works are, he has one called The Power of Myth. That's a nice kind of intro. And then he has one called The Hero with 1,000 Faces, where he studied every story he could find in every civilization and saw that it was the same story over and over and over with different names and different characters, but hitting the same beats every time. So, you know, he's super smart and has like, I don't know, 20 to 30 different parts of every story. So I wanted to make that as simple as possible to understand in really broad strokes, because I'm not academician. I'm living in the real world, just trying to help people tell the better stories. So for a good chunk of my career, 12 years or so, I did a lot of story consulting with like Fortune 100 companies and startups and nonprofits, trying to help them figure out how to view the life through that story lens. So I got it down to five things in my mind. So it's always starts with a hero. It can be a heroine. It's not gender specific, but there's a hero that's living in a normal world and they want a treasure. So the treasure is always twofold, right? It's always on the nose, like they want an adventure or they want a girlfriend or they want money or something. But underneath that, there's always a deeper treasure. They usually want acceptance or forgiveness or something like that. So the hero is always looking for a treasure, but they can't get it. They're not strong enough. They can't even get to the place where the treasure is. A dragon kind of stands in the way of them, like a monster, an antagonist. Often in these old mythic tales, they're literal dragons, literal sea monsters, like in Beowulf or something. But then a mentor comes along, and the mentor is the Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Gandalf, that gives them a sword. It's often a literal sword in all these stories, like Excalibur or a lightsaber or something. And the sword is also on two levels. So it's the physical power that can defeat the dragon, but really it represents what's inside the hero, like the force or whatever. But those five points then, so a hero who meets a mentor who gives them a sword, who defeats the dragon to get the treasure. I use those as the Cliff's Notes to kind of have everyone sort of talk about their story, and then, you know, in consultation, kind of break down your communication strategy around this, or your company culture around this. Is it's the story friendly culture, stuff like that. So that's the bulk of what I've been doing for the last part of my career.
Okay. Awesome. Well, so, you know, hero, mentor, sword, dragon, treasure, right?
Yep.
That's it. And so my question is, just out of curiosity, because I kind of see this sometimes when I'm working with folks, how challenged are people oftentimes to actually be able to clearly identify and describe and come to terms with the treasure that they really want?
It's harder for yourself. Like a lot of the work I do, you make assumptions. So if this is a, if we're working on a marketing campaign, then you're not the hero. That's the number one thing to realize in that scenario, right? You're always the mentor, your product's always the sword. So you make assumptions around the people that would need your product and what their treasures are. For us as individuals, when we try to factor in our own life and figure it out, we usually kind of know what our on the nose treasure is. Usually, for some of us, it feels a little shallow, and we hate to say it, but you know, it's usually something like, I want to make more money, so I can go on better vacations. I want my boss to quit being a dick. My wife and I to have a better relationship and not fight anymore. Or, you know, it's usually pretty on the surface, and sometimes maybe it's so obvious we don't see it. Now, the underneath, the real wound that we're trying to solve, I don't think it. We generally have a very good idea of that until, you know, later on in life, once we've been through enough sort of pain and kind of self-reflection. We discovered in the journey, right? So during the journey, we start to see, oh, you know, like maybe I really just feel like maybe some sort of loneliness, or maybe it's, I don't feel like I had a family, or I felt rejected since I was a kid. Like those things start to emerge, but usually it's in the process of just trying to get the girl to date me or get a raise.
Yeah. And I think and this kind of dovetails into, you know, the stuff that I enjoy, the stuff I work with is more existential, right? So I would do a lot of work with, I think a lot of what I do is influenced by people like Jean-Paul Sartre and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and, you know, Heidegger and all those guys. And this is the act into being kind of theory, right? It is, mm-hmm. You have to start. And it's interesting because that hero's journey is a journey. And I think that the treasure, as you so aptly said, you start off by looking at the one thing, and you start that journey, you start that odyssey, you know, you start that expedition. Or a quest, you know, I love the term quest, but I think mm-hmm. you start that. And then along the way, when you start doing some of this stuff, those things start to bubble up for us. And I think that's a really important part of leadership, is the willingness to live with that ambiguity and realize you're setting a direction, and that direction might change at some point, and being open to that change and not being so so convinced that the thing that you said earlier on was the only thing, because I think that shuts off the opportunities to see what you create as you go.
Yes. And you learn it two ways, or both ways, right? Like, if you actually get what you think your treasure is, it never satisfies. It always feels kind of lame. It's like when you were a kid, look forward for Christmas, and then the day after Christmas, you're like, meh, you know, I got what I wanted, but now what? And if you never get it, then you find it through like sort of trial, perseverance, pain, and feeling inept or whatever. But it works both ways, right? It's the treasure is not really that great in the end. It's the journey itself. That's why the boon, that's why the elixir, that's why the hero has to go back to where he started or she started and bring with them, you know, sometimes the pot of gold, but usually the lessons learned, bring them back to their people, to kind of teach them that thing. And then they slide into the mentor role at that point.
Yeah. And I think that's another interesting piece. I'm a big fan of Carl Jung and also, Campbell. And it's because of the, I don't know how else to say it, but it's a process orientation, right? It's not an outcome orientation. And there's one of our cognitive biases, one of the 180 they've identified, is the arrival fallacy. The very thing you just said, which is we think that once we arrive or we get something, that fixes something. And very rarely is that lasting or sustainable. It just leads to the next thing. And, you know, I told a group where you were actually with me, the group that you came down and spoke to last week. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, that's why I was never a big fan of the whole mountain climbing analogy, metaphor that people use nowadays. You see it all over the place. And I said, well, it works if you use a mountain range, right? Because once you summit, it changes your perspective of the horizon. And so now you see more things to do. So I think it's, and that's why what I do, it's very much about being relentless. Because it is that kind of this journey, this, and you mentioned it, which is a really interesting transition for people, that you do the journey again, you just are no longer the hero, you're the mentor, but you're still involved in the journey. So this is not a one and done kind of thing. Do you find that with the stuff that you do and with the people that you talk to?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's cyclical. It's like doubles on itself and it's cyclical. You're doing multiple journeys at one time. So I don't know if you're ever like so evolved that you never see yourself as a hero. I think we always have a hero's journey that we're going on. But the more sort of enlightened, evolved, screwed up you get, however you want to think about it, the more you start to enter stories purposely as a mentor instead of as a hero. And that's the big change, is realizing you can actually choose how you enter a story or a room. And be more concerned about helping others than helping yourself. On the mountain thing, I got to interview Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan priest, kind of a little bit of a Catholic rebel, and but he his books have always meaningful to me, and I never met him, and I got to interview him a few years ago. And I said, I in my 20s, I said I was an evangelical church planter pastor. I started a church, and he's, well, first he said, "I don't know why you evangelical pastors like me so much." He was like, "I'm Catholic, you know." It was just funny. And then he's like, the first thing he asked me, he was like, "What was the name of your church?" Which I thought was such a weird name. And I said, "Well, we called it Apex because we were trying to, it's a Gen X church when we were young." And he's like, "Of course you did." He's like, "That makes all the sense in the world. You had a mountain name." He's like, "The first half of your life is all about trying to climb that mountain. Of course you named it that." I was like, "All right, Richard Gore, there you go."
Well, that's, and I think it's Brooks. I forget his first name. Arthur Brooks, who wrote the second mountain, right? It's always the first mountain you climb and then the second mountain. And the other piece of this that's for me is really interesting is when you think about the hero's journey and all those pieces, one of the things that spun off in my head is that leaders, as a leader, it's interesting because as the hero or the mentor very much so. But recognizing that you do participate and play a role in someone else's story, because we're all humans, like, so we're always the star of our own story. We're always the star of our own movie. But it's interesting when we sit back and we think about the role we play, the supporting role we can play in other people's journeys. And to me, that's a really powerful thing, as you stated, because you're going through multiple ones at the same time. If you have kids and family and a company and you're leading a team, to fully recognize you're not the hero in every story. And that's something I think that is so powerful, to take on that best supporting actor or actress role vibrantly for somebody else.
Absolutely. Sometimes you're the dragon too. And sometimes you're the treasure. But I just wrote today on my Substack about the red shirts in Star Trek, and how they always die in the first scene or whatever, or NPCs in a video game. Not only are you sometimes the mentor in story, sometimes you're a red shirt. And I wrote about how when just two lessons when I think about that is, sometimes we let red shirts control our narrative. They actually aren't. They're just there to go away. Like, there's lots of people in our life that we may interact with a day or a month or a year, and they really aren't supposed to be shaping our story, but we will give them authority over our story. They'll hijack it. And then the other thing is, sometimes we're a red shirt, right? We aren't the mentor. We aren't very important actually in someone's story at all. We're just there to pass through. And our pride can make us want to have an influence on that story. And sometimes I said, it's not failure to be a red shirt in someone's story. It's actually freedom, because you don't have to worry about their story. You can focus on the ones you're supposed to be in. But anyway, that I just wrote about that today. But it is, we're entering everyone we meet, we're entering their story somewhere. But it could be a mentor, but it could be just a, that one, somebody's got to get the role in a movie to sell you the coffee at the Starbucks. That might be our role in their life.
And I think that's it's to your point, I think it you use the term freeing, and I think it is, there is a sense of freedom in knowing that you don't have to be a main character in everything. But I think it's hard for humans, right? And especially hard for people in leadership roles, because they take on the mantle of responsibility, and most of the time very seriously, but I think sometimes far too seriously, and they try to be everything to everybody. And then you can't be, you're nothing to anybody. But it's just interesting if we sat back and kind of created that list of all the people in our lives and kind of figure out what role, like to your point, am I the dragon in this particular one? Am I the hero? Am I the mentor? Am I a red shirt? Am I just playing a little part and then moving on? And then the freedom that would come along with that, I think would be pretty dramatic, I would think.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think, it's hard enough to it's hard enough to live our own story. When we start putting pressure on ourselves to play roles in others, that's a lot. That's a lot. And it's their story. So ultimately they have creative control, right? They're going to decide if we're the mentor or not, no matter what we want to be. We can offer it. We can be available to it. We can be open to it. So I just noticed as people get kind of more, it's a shift in why you want to be a mentor, right? Like, I remember wanting to be seen as a mentor in my 20s because I thought I was really smart. And I thought people a couple years younger than me should want to learn from me, but that was all pride ego stuff. And now it's more of an availability of being present to see if this is somewhere that I could be helpful or useful. I wrote about Nelson Mandela recently as well, where he, you know, like a revolutionary who is has a good cause, but ends up, you know, in prison for decades. And he comes out so different, but with the same cause and looking for a place to be useful. And there's something about that, maybe in my 50s now, I'm trying to think through that more.
Well, and I think too, and we didn't really talk about it, and you can share how this impacted you, but the improv work that you did in your life and how that impacted what you do, because I think there's such a humility in that transitions over into what you're talking about, because it's so funny. And I don't think most people outside, when you're looking at somebody doing improv, wouldn't think humility, but listening to you, having the chance to listen to you a couple times with groups and talking about, you know, when somebody starts the scene, whoever gets to start it starts it. And then it's up to the other person to contribute. Like you can't, and it was so interesting because, you know, somebody, and I'm sure you give an example, they say this one thing and you can't then go another direction. Your job is to embrace that and roll with it and make it into something so that the two people there, the three people there are now co-creating something. And I think that does take a tremendous sense of humility to participate in that, just like it does in leadership. But I'd like to hear what you think.
Yeah. For your listeners just getting to know me, I've had a weird career, by the way. So I was a preacher, and then I kind of burned out on that, and then I became an improviser, a comedian in Vegas, working for the Second City and doing improv shows and stuff like that. So, you know, improv, not stand up. There's a difference. So we're making up stories on the spot with a group of people. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think, I would go back to the word trust. Not that humility is not part of it, but you are trusting that your partner is going to be listening to you. And in Second City World, anyway, before every single show, we go around, we hit everybody we're playing with on the shoulder and say, "I got your back." That's just a tradition we have. But that's it. Like, I got your back. So, I'm not going to deny you. If you come out and say you're a doctor, I'm not gonna make you a zookeeper. I got your back. If you screw up and I say you're a doctor and you say you're a zookeeper, I got your back. You're both, we'll figure it out. So I think that is humility in the sense of I'm not driving the scene. We're doing it together. We're better together than we are on our own. That's why we're not doing stand-up comedy. But I think it's rooted in how real deep listening creates trust. And I'm sure you have to have humility to be able to do that at some level.
Oh, and also vulnerability, right? I mean, you got to be willing to step out there and you just said, I got you, you know, everybody says you got your back. That's the vulnerability comes after that, because like, okay, I can take a risk because I know I have this person or these people who are going to be there regardless. You know, we'll figure it out. And that's the other thing you said. It was, there's never anything wrong. You just keep going. And I think that's a life lesson, right? I mean, the hero's journey or any of those things, that's life. I mean, there's nothing wrong. You just got to keep going. Because oftentimes if we get so hung up in right and wrong, did I do it well? Did I fail? Did I, you know, we talked about the arrival fallacy, but on failure on the other side, I think it was credited to Mike Ditka. It's like, you know, failure is never fatal and success is never final. And all of that is, you know, and I think these, and it's actually why I had you speak to the group, because that those precepts, those concepts of improv, to me are so meaningful in just human relations. let alone transitioning over to leadership. And I'm sure, you know, you probably have thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when we say in improv, like, there are no mistakes, or just keep going. I mean, what, it's always a weird thing to teach people at first, because you teach them the rules and then you say there's no mistakes, because we're all going to accidentally break the rules. But what we mean by no mistakes is you keep going, and we use the term justify, like you justify it. So if a mistake is made, like if the one I just said, like we said you were Dr. Anna Zookeeper, that's pretty easy, right? We just make you a vet. But in the process, we figure it out. So what we don't say, what the opposite of justifying is trying to, you know, say, you don't deny, I'm not a zookeeper. I said I was a doctor. That's an early improv level one class scene that I've seen a million times when I teach people, right? We're just going to argue about who I am. Whereas we want to say yes, and we want to get to a place. And I think in the real world, it's not about justifying the role, but it's about accepting that, you know, I'm in a room with a meeting. I mean, how many times have you been here? You're meeting with a couple people, maybe a client, one of your employees or whatever, and they're telling two different stories. Like, they are not on the same page. They are not. And you, as if you're a leader or a mediator or whatever, you have to accept both truths. You can't. Like, this is where we are. You know what I mean? Like, you have to, and I think so many people don't like reality. So you reframe it as something else, when sometimes it's better just to say yes and just call it out. Like, seems like we're telling two different stories here. Let's figure out what's going on, as opposed to kind of like avoiding the elephant in the room or whatever.
Well, and also in that situation, trying to deny one or the other. Right. It's like both you, when you have that situation, oftentimes there are elements of truth in everything everybody's saying. Like, there is no right or wrong. It's just degrees. And being able to, and I love that, justify, not deny. It's like, let's just talk about how these things, what do we take from everybody and say, okay, elements of everything that are true. So what can we do with it now? Because you're still left with, but I think we lean so heavily into judgment. That's our default. And I think I don't think it's wrong, because I think for a great deal of our percent of our lives, judgment's important, you know, right, wrong, good, bad, dangerous, safe, you know, that we need those things. Our brain works that way. But there is that element, that percentage of the time where that works against us, when we should be curious, you know, when we should, because the way I look at it is there's three things we can't do if we're judging, three more very important things. They all begin with the letter L, and that's lead, love, and learn. We can't do any of those things if we're judging. And so to that point, I think you have to live in a little bit of ambiguity a lot of times. And I love that example. You're sitting there and it all goes back to what you said earlier. It all goes back to listening, like that really deep intentional listening to hear what people are saying and allow them. Not only can they say it, but they're allowed to say it. And I think that's the great thing about the improv lessons, is you're allowed to say anything, as long as it moves things forward. And I think developing that muscle, and you saw this and I saw this with the group we were working with, they were so, I just used the word tight. Like, they were so tight and rigid almost when you were asking them to do certain things. And we talked about it after in the afternoon. It was just funny to talk to them about it and get them to really sit with it, to think about, you know, no, there was no judgment. Nobody was winning. Nobody was losing. But so many of them just couldn't do what you were asking them to do.
Yes, it was a little bit of a harder crowd that day. They were more resistant, which is fine. And then I told you I got a nice note from the CEO later saying it was helpful, so I'm like, good. One of the things improv teaches you, when you do like an improv workshop, you make them do silly little games, right? The whole point is to look a little silly. Look, there's games I can make them play that look way sillier, so I'm being nice to them. You see how everything's rooted in fear and insecurity. Mm-hmm. So how we can be afraid to just look silly in front of our coworkers. I get it, but that's so deeply rooted. And it there's a connection between some level of appropriate vulnerability about our fears and insecurities, you know, at work. Not all, this isn't therapy, but some level of it is what builds that trust. And so there's some connection in fear and trust. When in the real world, anytime I see defensiveness, like you're talking about, or judgment, You know, coming from religious world, plenty of that. So it's nearly always rooted in insecurity and your own fears. And, you know, it's a classic almost trope at this point, but when the televangelist or pastor falls because he has some sin, it's always the thing he preached against the most, whatever it is. Cause you know, all of life is sort of like, sometimes we aggressively judge the things in us. And we never get more angry at other people than when they remind us of the thing we don't want people to see in us.
Well, and I think, and the kind of the flips, the more self-aware side of that statement is, I think it was Jung who said the best way of when we deal with the darkness in ourselves, it helps us deal with the darkness in others. Right. And yes. That's the flip side of not getting caught in that, because once we can acknowledge the things that, you know, our own insecurities and fears, we don't project them onto other people and get hypersensitive to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if it's not the same insecurities you have, once you know you have them, you start to also see them in others, and it you respond, you know, as ideally, this is my worldview, like, right, like you begin to respond more with empathy and grace than judgment, because you know, if they saw yours, it's no better. Like, that's what it's, you know, it's interesting how you study your whole life and end up back at the golden rule or whatever. But like in the end, it's like you treat people like you want to be treated. And we are all pretty broken walking around pretending like we're not. It's just some of us are aware of it and some aren't.
And there was, and I don't want to entirely, I want to get to a point, or I wanted you to speak to something, because it's kind of where we started with storytelling and leadership. But I find that, and you said, and you can bring it up again, but here was the gist that I took away. It was about how telling a story connects better than, and you mentioned earlier, data and facts. And I think being a leader in an organization, and you know, regardless of where it is, if it's a nonprofit, profit, doesn't matter. But it feels like a lot of times nowadays we get so consumed with data and data points and facts that we start talking about that, and we lack a story. And so we feel misaligned, because we're not able to generate the response we want, but yet we're defaulting to talking about facts and data and rules and all of that. And how easy is it for you, when you work with companies, to get them to embrace the story and get rid of all the, you know, the features and benefits?
Yeah, it's really hard. And because it, you know, I spent a lot of my career helping people create like commercials and videos. So we'll go through this process, mainly going through this process so we can figure out their next campaign or what the commercial, and you know, every single time we'll go through this process, we'll have a draft that's really story driven, and they'll start editing it, and it gets edited by committee. I can't tell you how many times I think we're like, this is going to be this commercial. Once it airs, we're going to get so much work from it because it's so great. It tells the story. People are going to react to it. And by the end, we don't even like it as creatives, because it gets the committee, or either the committee or just the CEO comes in from on high and starts taking the story out to put more facts and data in. I do understand the instinct, because look, there is a point where actually data does close a deal. And so, if you're actually down to trying to decide between, you know, a Toyota and a Nissan, maybe a chart comparison would help you make that final call. But until then, you're just you're asking, can I trust this person? And do they know me? Do they see me? Do they see what I want? So at that stage, it's all story. It's all connection. And we know, you know, I'm certainly not a scientist, but I've read a few of them. And what we know is that when people hear a story, they turn off the part of their brain that wants to argue until the story's over. Like, it just happens, because our brains so desperately want the story to finish. We turn off everything else. We're looking for beginning, middle, and end, resolution. And then afterwards we can judge it. But also, when you say any fact, your brain does the opposite. If you just make a firm statement, your brain's going to automatically, for survival reasons, I think, ask, is that true? And you're going to play devil's advocate or whatever. You don't play devil's advocate when people tell a story, typically, unless you've already lost their trust or something. you let the story finish. So, and we even know people's brainwaves match up when they listen to a storyteller. It has an interesting, mysterious cosmic connection with people. And data doesn't do that. Reading off facts does not make your brain, it does the opposite. It makes us want to argue. So,
well, and that kind of takes us back to Campbell, right? Because the storytelling is been done for, you know, whatever you believe or how many years you want to go back, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions, whatever. But that was really what Campbell said. I mean, he studied people all over the earth, everywhere, in every conceivable location and nationality. And that's how he came up. He said every story everybody is telling has the same components.
Yeah, that's why I love The Hero with a Thousand Faces as the title, right? Because it's the faces change, but the story doesn't. It's always a search for meaning and redemption at some level. So it's what that tells us is that it's our human, I don't know, it's like our, spiritual is a weird word, but it's like our psychological DNA maybe. Like it's as much as now we crack the code on physically our DNA, there is through millennia of struggle, we also are born into a species that has its own psychological DNA, and it's all story driven. That's how we make meaning, and we are desperate for meaning because we are, for better or worse, self-aware.
Yeah. Some of us. Well, and I think too that would also just the point that we tell a story where. And in Campbell's version, you go into the underworld or whatever that is, that in the story is the brokenness that you mentioned earlier, which is just, you know, it is pretty, it's not really overwhelming, but it's almost, it's awe inspiring when you think of, you know, people sitting around a campfire in sub-Saharan Africa and people in Asia and people in, you know, the Arctic, and no matter what, they're all telling, you know, every as you can ascribe to, every great movie or book or anything anybody's ever done always has the same process in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and just to like, I love the one you brought up. So it's, we have to go to the depths or the cave or the belly of the whale. So you got the Jonah story at the belly of the whale, right? Like that's clearly from my perspective a myth about when you get swallowed up by life and you're just stuck in the darkness. But keep it in religious tradition, Jesus has to go in a tomb for 3 days. If you go over to like, you know, more like Gandalf when he fights the Balrog or whatever, he has to fall. It's all, you're usually descending into the earth in these stories over and over again. Beowulf when he defeats Grendel, but now he has to defeat Grendel's mother, who's like the mother of his fears. So he has to go deep into the water to do that. Harry Potter goes into some deep forest. Like it's just every single movie you watch, and every ancient story or modern story you see, you're like, oh, there it is. They went to the cave. And the easy, Luke's, I know I'm a nerd on this stuff, right? But in Return of the Jedi, so Luke has to literally go into the bowels of the Death Star. He's already destroyed it once. Now they rebuilt it. So he's got to go in there and face his huge treasure temptation, which is to have control and to have meaning and let the emperor be his father figure. So he's got to kill the emperor, save his own dad. Like it's all in there, but it's all this descent into the cave or the belly of the whale or the depths. And so when, what if you put it in your own story, what does that feel like? Well, it feels dark and empty and scary and cold and alone. Like it feels like you're in the middle of the earth all alone. So that's, you can see why, you know, as our ancestors became self-aware and wanted to tell truths, it's all just metaphor. And any great truth must have metaphor. If you can explain something without metaphor, it's not a very deep truth. Mm-hmm. So we had to create those metaphors to try to explain why is there suffering? Why is there pain? Why am I going through this?
And so let's take that and move to my final question for you. So why is it important or not important? Why could it be beneficial? Let's put it this way, because nobody has to do this, but why would it be beneficial for anybody that leads an organization to have a clear grasp of both their story and the organization's story?
I guess I'd go back to like the hero's journey for them and the on the nose and the deeper level. So on the nose, if you don't know your story, you're gonna eventually go bankrupt. Like if you have to know where you're going. You have to have a vision, and you have to know who your customer, client, who the person is you're serving, and what they want. And you have to put it in story terms, or you won't get their attention. So, you know, most entrepreneurs kind of have to get it. Like, it's not like you're not doing it. It's mm-hmm. just that you, your instincts got you so far, but now we need to really step back and say, like, look, like it your instincts are right. You had to tell a story, and you did, but you weren't very intentional about it. Really, you just kind of did it. So, or you grew so fast. This happens a lot, right? A company grows so fast, they have three or four stories, and now it's just a mess. And now it's but the growth can cover up your lack of attention to your story for a while, just like it can cover up lack of, structure or integrity or whatever. But eventually you'll figure it out. But on the deeper level, then I would say what surprised me that probably it shouldn't is it started like right before COVID. And then a lot after that, a lot of the companies that were using my services or for outward focused communication, like marketing or whatever, shifted my work to HR. Like suddenly the HR director started becoming the people hiring me because they realized their company was not a story friendly company, not a story driven culture. They realized that when we tell stories, we create more belonging and a safer place. And that's really sort of my jam anyway. Like I'm a little more into like helping people be better people and get along than I am selling mops or whatever I was doing. So I have enjoyed that, but as I think about it, it's like, it is both things, right? So these, you can help a company figure out what their perceived treasure is, which is some sort of ROI always. But underneath it, what they actually really want is to like show up to work and be okay. Like, even for the owner, if I'm making a ton of money, but I got to go work every day and it's miserable because we can't get on the same page, like that's a deeper heart level treasure that they sort of had the same solution, right? Which is to tell the same story, to trust and listen and not be driven by our insecurities and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I can see why companies with the HR, that the people side of the business wanted to talk to you because, it's like the opportunity when you talk about data and story, putting out a job description that has job responsibilities and all of those data points, all those facts, it doesn't elicit any kind of emotional. It actually gives you every reason not to go to work there, as opposed to if they have a great story they can share. It's lessening, which I love what you said. Nobody, when you're hearing a story, nobody wants to argue with it. It isn't. You're not finding fault with it. I once heard, and this goes to a resume too, but I actually heard somebody say a resume is just a list of reasons why somebody wouldn't want to hire you. And so why do you send it? But it's that point, right? It's like, it's not a story. It's just a bunch of facts that I can quickly say, oh, I disagree with that. That's not right. That doesn't fit, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say, that's you ask a HR director, where have you gotten your best employees? And they're almost always going to say referrals, right? Like either someone that works here said that, or someone that knows about us, a customer referred them. Well, that's storytelling. Like that, if you're recruiting, they already know the very best way to get good people to work here is to create a culture where other people want to invite their friends to work there. Mm-hmm. That's it. And that's another great example of how if we think of hiring as a list of data points. You're going to get this salary, this healthcare, you're going to get this many weeks vacation. It's not that stuff doesn't matter, but if you got a pretty good offer, but then you got a buddy that works there, he's like, this place sucks. Like it's awful. Or maybe you're deciding between two and one pays a little less vacation, but you have people saying, I've never been happier. Like they treat you like a human. Like, so you're just going to go with the story. You're always going to go. The story is how you make a decision, no matter what unless you can trump the story in your head. So if I think I'm going to make $100,000, they're saying I'll pay you $2 million a year. You're like, I can tell a story where I'm miserable for 2 years. I can live that story. Something can be so seemingly good that you're going to say yes to it. But generally speaking, it's going to be like, is this a story I want to align myself with?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Joe, it's been great. I appreciate your time and I appreciate your insight and all of the things you shared, because they're very meaningful, I think, to people. And it's something that everybody knows about, but I don't think always connects the dots. Why don't you, before we're done here, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you? So if they do like what you do, they can get a hold of you.
Sure. JoeBoyd.net. And I don't have .com because it's $5,000. That's the joke there. And that's true. So it's JoeBoyd.net. That's like where you can learn about my speaking workshops and book me for something if you want that. I also have a Substack that's called Called for Adventure, calledforadventure.com. I write every day about storytelling. That's completely free if you just want some storytelling stuff. And then I'm on pretty easy to find on LinkedIn. So not that hard to get to.
All right. Awesome. Well, I certainly appreciate your time and your energy and your insights, and I look forward to working with you again soon.
Thanks, Barry. All right. Appreciate it.